Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the podcast, and I'd like to remind our listeners that they can subscribe to and rate this program on iTunes or Stitcher, where in addition to our website, all of our previous interviews may be streamed or downloaded. So for today's program, I'm speaking with John Alba Cutler, author of Ends of Assimilation, The Formation of Chicano Literature, published by Oxford University Press in 2015. Dr. Cutler is an assistant professor of English at Northwestern University, where he specializes in U.S. Latino literatures, multi-ethnic American poetry, contemporary American literature, and print cultural studies. Hello, John, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Hi, DJ. Thanks so much for having me on.
Great. Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you, and I was hoping you can begin our discussion today by telling us a little bit about your personal and professional background.
Sure, absolutely. So I come from Salt Lake City originally. I come from a mixed family. My dad's family is white, Anglo, and my mom comes from a family of migrant farm workers. She grew up in Piedras Negras in Coahuila, Mexico. And that kind of bicultural family background was always really, really important to me. When I got to college, I encountered Chicano literature and Latino literature for the first time, and it really kind of changed my own understanding of, you know, my place in the world, my family's history, and all that. I ended up getting a PhD in English from UCLA and wrote my dissertation on the topic that would eventually become Ends of Assimilation. And so that's my family background.
Yeah, I think you're the first Salt Lake City native that I've talked to. So I find that interesting. Where do you do your undergraduate work?
I went to BYU there in Utah.
Oh, yeah. Great. Great. In Provo. Yeah, I got a lot of friends that went there as well. Well, a number of them. My sister went there as well. So great. Well, that's
really
neat.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a neat trajectory from Salt Lake to LA, UCLA, and now you're at Northwestern in Chicago.
Yeah, a little different. I had a friend in grad school in film, Rob Hernandez, who's from Denver, and he used to say we were the Mountain Chicanos, which it is.
Nice. Well, you know, one of the things that really caught my attention about your book, you know, in association with this channel and my own work and teaching and research, I'm, of course, always looking for new stuff. But the title really stood out to me, and I don't remember exactly where I saw it, whether I was scanning Oxford's catalog or something. But again, the title just kind of grabbed me, and particularly as I started to read the book and realize how it signals, you know, your project to analyze Chicano literature alongside assimilation sociology. And for me, I'm a historian by training, right? So I have my favorite pieces of Chicano literature, of course, but I in no means consider myself well-read. So I don't know if this is a very common theme in Chicano literary studies or criticism. But it is, in fact, the central theme of your book, you know, to examine the tension or disjuncture between these two genres, or as you refer to them, I love this quote here, two institutionalized discursive fields, that advance rival representations of the same process. So to get us started on the book, will you talk a bit about this tension between, you know, these two discursive fields that are at the, really at the central of your book?
Yeah, absolutely. And so it's funny that you draw attention to the title, because actually the way that the way that this book evolved has something to do with seeing the tension between these two discursive fields. The thing that I wrote in graduate school, the dissertation that I wrote, the title was originally Assimilation and Its Discontent. And I was thinking about sort of literary texts that thematize processes of assimilation. But I really, the book was more psychoanalytic. It was more interested in individual subject formation and desire and gender and things like that. And it was in revising the dissertation and kind of looking around and trying to broaden my sense of how scholars had engaged with the idea of assimilation that I began to see that there was this huge body of sociological literature about assimilation that was really complicated and interesting, but very obviously very different from what I was encountering in the literary texts themselves. So I ended up doing a sort of crash course in sociology and assimilation sociology specifically. And the thing that I found that was so interesting was that although assimilation, right, the sort of changes in culture, language acquisition, changes in class status, all of those things that seem to be that we refer to with the shorthand of assimilation. So although all of those things are thematized just incessantly in Chicano literary texts, the way that Chicano literary texts think about them and talk about them is really different from the way that sociologists have historically done so. Right. And that difference began to be really interesting to me, partly because my sense was that the sociology had been really influential in just American culture generally in a way that wasn't the case for Chicano literature.
Yeah, no, that is really neat how you notice that. And that's something that, you know, it's that, again, I'm not very well read, at least in the forms of Chicano literature, or typically the classics. But it's, you know, as you brought it up and as I was reading through the introduction, it became so clear to me that this is, you know, that this the themes and aspects of the underlying assumptions that are based in assimilation, you know, theories and sociology are really key themes in a lot of, you know, Chicano literary works. And so I wanted to talk a bit more about that, and in the introduction, particularly, this book is a literary history. You track the development of Chicano literature alongside its intersection with an engagement with assimilation sociology, as we have been discussing here. And so it forms, you know, chronologically, and you begin with some works that came out before the initial Chicano movement. We'll get to that, but I wanted to focus more about the disjuncture between the two histories that you bring up, and that is the history of sociological thought and the history of Chicano literature. So will you talk about that a bit, about how these two histories are a bit misaligned?
Of course. So I think that they're misaligned in a really important way. This is a claim that I make in the introduction to my book. The misalignment refers to the kind of strange institutionalization of the two discourses. So assimilation sociology, it enters public discourse and it enters higher education really with the Chicago School of Sociology in the 1920s and 1930s, and all of the big names associated with that, Robert Park and Louis Wirth and Leo Sroll and W. Lloyd Warner and all of those guys. And it was, I think there's several aspects to the way that assimilation began to be described by these sociologists, several aspects that are really important. So one aspect that is really important is that assimilation, because it was initially advanced as a kind of anti-racist discourse, it was supposed to be an answer to the eugenics and nativist movements of the 1910s and 20s, it put a lot of emphasis on the mutability of ethnicity and culture. So the the idea of change over time, and that eventually ethnic differences would fade. Another really important feature of this assimilation sociology was that it focused mainly on white European ethnic groups in the Northeast, and mostly in Northeastern urban settings. So we're looking at the assimilation of really the big immigrant groups from the beginning of the 20th century, Italians and Greeks and Eastern European Jews, and many of these groups that are associated with the Immigration Act of 1924 and the beginning of immigration quotas. So that's another really important aspect, because what it meant was that all of the focus on ethnicity meant that assimilation sociology developed this really, really kind of uncomfortable blind spot or inability to think about race. It was unable to incorporate an analysis of blackness, for example, into the kind of paradigms of assimilation. And then one other really important feature of the way that this discourse was consolidated was that it took for granted that the nation was the natural unit for thinking about culture, right? So it thought about something like American culture, and it sort of assumed that we all understood what the boundaries of that culture were. So that assimilation was always about basically passing from some kind of ethnic culture into this American culture. So to go back to this idea of misalignment, of course, the Chicano movement, all the activism that we associate with it, really comes to its apex in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And it's a time period when, because of the rise of ethno-nationalist movements, the kind of multiculturalism in higher education, assimilation sociology has really fallen out of favor. So there's not a lot of sociologists who are continuing to advance the ideas and arguments of assimilation sociology. And in fact, the Chicano movement, alongside the Black Arts movement and the American Indian movement and these other ethno-nationalist movements, the activists in this movement see themselves as anti-assimilationists in a really important way. So the way that they see themselves as anti-assimilationists is in response to the nationalism of the earlier mode of assimilation, and a way that the ideas of these sociologists got translated into popular culture. But what I wanted to, I guess what I wanted to say about the misalignment, though, that I think is so important, is that because the activists in the Chicano movement weren't sharing the field with assimilation sociologists, there's a way that there's never really a conversation between what's happening between the literary works and the sociology. So the assumptions of each field are never being questioned one against the other.
Right.
And I think that leads to interesting consequences for both sociology and literature.
Well, yeah, and I'm thinking in particular, it's not, as you bring up this misalignment, right? It was more the case that Chicano authors were kind of responding in ways, or at least in representing their culture, countering in ways these theories, whether intentionally or not. But it's not as if there's ever a conversation between the two, because it's not like assimilation sociologists or theorists were essentially ever aware of Chicano literature until very recently. Now you may have some that are reading it and engaging with it, or at least know of it while they're forming and revising theories. But so in that way, that's why this is a history of intersecting, themes and concepts, right, as opposed to any type of, discourse between the two.
Right. Yeah. No, that's exactly right. And I think another, really kind of important thing about this misalignment is that the way that we the assumptions that we bring to thinking about what Chicano literature represents when it's thinking about assimilation We don't recognize where they come from, right? Because these things aren't emerging simultaneously, right? So we can say, we can see the way that Chicana literature is responding maybe to an earlier discourse, or responding to something. I think, I actually think in general that the way, literary scholars have read Chicana literature and read the way that it treats assimilation is that they're responding to the idea of assimilation without mm-hmm. really saying where that idea comes from.
Right.
So to kind of excavate or trace back at least a genealogy of ideas about assimilation, I think really helps us see what's at stake in the kinds of representations that Chicana literature is putting forth and the kinds of changes that it's trying to make in how we understand the way that culture works.
Right. And on that notion, in the changes to culture, that's in fact one of your contentions that, Chicano literature has in many ways been interpreted primarily as anti-assimilationist, but you argue that's just, one strand of, Chicano literature writing. So can you explain that a bit further, particularly the other strand that doesn't get as much coverage?
Yeah, thank you. I think that's a great question and a really important one. And I feel that this is a really important part of my argument. So I think it's important first to say that when I say that Chicano literature is not anti-assimilationist, and I really think that the majority of Chicano literature is not anti-assimilationist, what I mean is that anti-assimilationism, that term, it makes the same assumptions that assimilationism does mm-hmm. about the way that cultural change happens.
Right.
Anti-assimilationism, right, would be to say that it's true that when there are, two cultures that encounter one another, that you have a choice about which culture to, which culture to make your own, and that you can simply, cross a boundary that separates you from the dominant culture, and then therefore that choice is sort of a choice about loyalties and, about politics.
Right.
But, the way that we experience culture is really a lot more complicated than that, right? There are a lot of things about the way that we experience culture that are out of our control. Language, for example, is really good. Language is a really good example of this. So I begin the book by quoting from this poem by Lorna de Cervantes called Barco de Refugiados, or Refugee Ship, mm-hmm. which is printed bilingually in Cervantes' book Emplumada, and it's in the poem the poet talks about kind of standing before the mirror. She says, I see in the mirror my reflection, bronzed skin, black hair, and she can see her sort of embodied racial identity.
Mm-hmm.
But in the poem she's also expressing anxiety about linguistic fluency. She says, Mama raised me without language. I'm orphaned from my Spanish name. And I think this is a really good example of how some, aspects of culture operate beyond our control and how that can lead to a lot of anxieties on the part of individuals and on the part of groups, right? I think that, a lot of Chicanos, a lot of Latinos would intuitively understand the anxiety that Cervantes is expressing there about right. linguistic fluency, right? Like not being able to speak Spanish as well as, relatives from Mexico, or as well as somebody from another generation, or conversely speaking Spanish much better than, a monolingual English speaker, or in my case, varying degrees of fluency, even among like siblings in my family, or cousins or something like that, right? And that can be a point of a lot of anxiety. It can be a point of kind of social sorting, sorting people into hierarchies of more or less authentic. My point then about Chicano literature not being anti-assimilationist is that Chicano literature understands how complicated these things are. It understands how much of this is out of the control of individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And so many Chicano literary texts are more interested in portraying the complexity of cultural encounters, the complexity of cultural change, the many different choices and trade-offs that happen, that my argument is that anti-assimilationism doesn't capture that sense. It doesn't capture the sense of that complexity. It's not about simply hanging on to Mexican culture and not choosing American culture, right? It's about, thinking about all of the different factors that play into these choices.
Right, and that also, in fact, that Chicano literature is actually evidence that Chicano culture itself and ethnic Mexican culture is, it's not static, right? It's evolving, it's productive, So in that way also, in just producing these cultural artifacts, if you will, or representations, that inherently changes the culture or evolves the culture, right? Rather than even if one is reflecting on one's past experience, it's not that simple aspect of just trying to cling on to and maintain an element of culture is in opposition to the dominant, American culture, so-called American culture, right?
Yeah, I think absolutely. That's absolutely right. I think that's a really important, a really important facet of representation that we have to keep in mind, that no representation is simply transparent. No language is simply transparent. So one version of anti-assimilationism, as you referred to there, would be something like cultural maintenance, right?
Right.
Something like saying we need to hang on to and preserve and maintain Chicano culture or Mexican culture how it is. But what's the way to do that, right? Well, let's say, one way you might do that is by writing a poem or a novel about a certain aspect of Chicano culture. But the second you write the poem, you're shaping it.
Right.
You're transforming the culture in a sense. You're creating it. So it's a little bit of a quixotic enterprise, mm-hmm. right? Not just a little bit. I think it's an entirely quixotic enterprise.
Right.
But I want to say that Chicano literature is aware of that. Chicano cultural production in general. Although, my specialty is in literature, Chicano literature is aware of that. It's not trying to just hang on. It's trying to advance and move forward and always create new forms that are dynamic and challenging and rich and complicated. And this is actually, I think, one of the blind spots of assimilation sociology, in that assimilation sociology, particularly during the heyday of the Chicago School in the 20s and 30s and 40s, thinks of itself as a scientific discourse,
right?
A discourse that can describe with some precision, some empirical precision, what is happening in the culture. But you can see that the rise of assimilation sociology, it introduces something into the culture. It introduces a way of talking about cultural encounters
that's
been profoundly influential. I think that this is something that especially that early generation of sociologists was blind to, was the fact that they weren't just describing culture, they were creating it, mm-hmm. right? They were mm-hmm. producing it and influencing it.
Well, and I think this is why your training, particularly in literature, is got you to see this key intersection between the two literatures or genres, that through the lens of literary discourse. Because you make the point in particular that, that assimilation, you address assimilation as ideology and not empirical science. Through the fact that it is shaping discourse, and it's not merely, this disinterested observer of a social process, but that assimilation itself is reinscribing, and even to quote here, it reinscribes as fact the fiction of one, a unitary national culture. It ignores the mm-hmm. interlinking of race and gender in cultural formation. It valorizes upward economic mobility, all of these things, right? And so I wonder if you can expound a bit more on that, on this aspect, and particularly your intersecting and interpretation of assimilation sociology through the lens of literary discourse.
Yeah, thank you. This is all so important, right? That The way that assimilation sociology unfolds is through language, right? I mean, there of course there are studies that are done. There are certain things that you can quantify. But at its root, I want to say assimilation sociology is a story that we tell, and it's a story that we tell about how how immigrants or how ethnic Americans become simply American, right, without the ethnic attachment.
Right.
So the various parts of that sentence that you quoted are what I think are really important parts of this story. So one of them is that there is such a thing as American culture, which I think I had alluded to earlier when talking about the way that assimilation sociology came to be. Mm-hmm. So I think that there are many different American cultures. I think, the United States is a really big place. Mm-hmm. And it's a place that has a lot of different regional cultures, a lot of different ethnic cultures, a lot of different class cultures. And the fiction of this kind of unified American culture that ethnic subjects or immigrants should aspire to is really damaging, because for one thing, how is any individual going to identify which is the right American culture to assimilate to?
Exactly.
But for another thing, even for white middle class Americans, right? It allows this kind of presumption of superiority or transparency, right? That my cultural values are somehow universalizable. So that's one really important part of the story that assimilation sociology tells. Another really important part of the story that assimilation sociology tells is that assimilation is something that kind of happens in this abstract, rarefied intellectual space. And what I mean by that is that it doesn't happen to raced and gendered bodies. Gender is almost completely absent from assimilation sociology, as is sexuality. And I think this is a really, really important, a really significant contribution of Chicano literature, is that it is always attuned to the ways that changes in culture or encounters between culture shake us to the core of who we are. And often the core of who we are is, I want to say always, is bound up with how we imagine desire and with how we see ourselves in gendered and in raced terms. So, I'll just say one really great example of this, a novel that I love is Arturo Islas' The Rain God, a novel from the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And the main character of that novel is a gay man, a Mexican-American man, lives in San Francisco, and he feels really dislocated and alienated from his Mexican family that he grew up in El Paso, Texas. And one way of understanding his alienation would be through the old terms of assimilation, right? That he's come to see himself as American. He's middle class. He's an artist, right? That he's right. He's made certain choices that have distanced himself from his Mexican past. I think that would be a really strong misreading and misunderstanding of the novel. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a really kind of complicated relationship between the narrator's gender and sexuality, his sense of being insufficiently masculine for his Mexican father, for example, that feed into his physical and spiritual dislocation and alienation from his family. And if you don't factor those things into it, right, then you're flattening out and you're reducing his experience as well as your own your own understanding of what that novel does and what it produces.
Yeah, no, and that's a great point. And it brings to mind for me a term that you refer to frequently throughout the book and in regards to assimilation, and that is the specter of assimilation discourse. Can you expand on that a little bit and talk about how, the assimilation discourse itself, has this, kind of, we've addressed the mysticism of it to some extent, but also this kind of, the spectral notion of it, it's kind of always there. It's underlying a lot of discussions. People bring it into discussions when it's not intended, or necessarily implicitly, explicitly addressed. So can you explain that a bit further and how you see that operating, how you see assimilation discourse working in that way?
Yeah, thank you. I see it operating in a couple of really important ways. One way is that one reason that I call it a specter and I portray it as something that is kind of looming is that I think it has animated implicitly, if not explicitly, but implicitly, a lot of Chicano literary scholarship. It animates the impulse to evaluate the authenticity of certain modes of representation, right? To say that this one is authentically Chicano or authentically Mexican, and this one is not. And I want to say that it also animates, or it also looms over the attempts of artists, of writers, when they're creating literary works, right? So knowing that they're going to, knowing that you're going to be judged for the authenticity of the thing that you put forward, and that those anxieties are always they're always kind of simmering on the surface of Chicano literary texts. Mm-hmm. So that's one place where I see the specter of assimilation kind of looming. I also think though that the specter of assimilation looms at a kind of larger level in American culture generally, in the assumptions that we make about how assimilation happens. And that this is right. Something that Chicano literature shares with other ethnic literatures, Asian American literature, especially. There's a lot of affinities between the two literatures in this mm-hmm. sense of knowing that in the dominant culture that people think they think that assimilation is basically just a choice that you make,
right?
And that they don't really understand the kind of agonistic, painful, and long-term consequences of certain choices, and they also don't understand the obstacles, all of the things that are kind of outside of an individual's hands that affect an individual's ability to integrate into American culture. So those are the two places where I see the specter of assimilation. Just kind of looming over this book and this discourse.
Great. Thanks for that. And real quickly, before we get in, I do want to discuss some of the examples that you bring up in the chapters. But before we get to that, it's something you also bring up in the introduction that part of, I don't know if I'm saying this correctly, but part of the motivation perhaps for this book is that you noticed, not just the correlations between assimilation, the initial, assimilation theory as it was, put forward by Park and Burgess and the Chicago School, but, a sort of resurgence that has come particularly in late 20th century and early 21st century as scholars have revived the theory or have critiqued it and, formed their own, other notions, but it all kind of fits within this body that you refer to as assimilation sociology. And in large part, your book, what it does, I think, really a great job at mm-hmm. doing it. Chapter by chapter, it selects a few works to address, those kind of the big, signposts, if you will, and assumptions that undergird all of these theories, whether they are theories that have tried to right. critique assimilate, traditional classical assimilation theory or their more recent ones, so can you talk a bit about that?
About this resurgence?
About the resurgence, yeah, and how your book fits in, as maybe, I don't know if you went so much as a response to it, but it certainly intersects with this resurgence in assimilation sociology.
Yeah, it definitely does. So I think it's both, it's both a response and I think a little bit of an attempt to build and to be part of a conversation. So You're right, right, that there has been this resurgence. This is something I try to detail in the book, and the work of contemporary sociologists like Richard Alba and Victor Ney, Edwin Tellez and Vilma Ortiz, Tomás Jiménez, among many others, Julie Agus Vallejo, who I think is at your institution there at USC.
Right.
And in many respects, the work of these contemporary sociologists, I want to say, is really, it's brilliant, it's complicated, it's a necessary and really important re-envisioning of the possibilities of assimilation.
Right.
So I absolutely don't want to portray myself as discounting or dismissing these works. I think they're really important. I'll just say really quickly that I strongly recommend Tomás Jiménez's work, especially. I think that's a really brilliant book. But I do, however, want to say that the thing that the contemporary assimilation sociology seems to have retained from that earlier Chicago school moment is a faith in the kind of scientific descriptive power of sociological discourse.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the arguments that my book wants to make is that literature and literary discourse does something different and something that is really valuable. And to the extent that we, especially in public discourse, in the ways that politicians speak, the kinds of things that make NPR or CNN, there's a really immense privileging of social science in those venues. And I want to say that literature has something to offer, that literature has a more complex and a more self-conscious understanding of how culture operates, because it's always conscious of being a cultural discourse. So that's partly the response that I hope that the book makes to this resurgence in assimilation sociology.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for that. Well, I did want to turn to a couple of the chapters, and let's start with the first one, and it's entitled Becoming Mexican-American Literature. And that's where you begin by examining, as I mentioned earlier, three pre-Chicano movement works labeled so-called Mexican-American novels. Although many scholars view these early works as assimilationist narratives in ways, that is, stories that tell of or advocate an assimilationist type of perspective, or at least interpreted that way, you argue that these works disrupt fundamental assumptions about race and gender within assimilation sociology. So you can discuss that in particular, how these works do so, you know, and even how maybe towards the latter and how they became interpreted by, you know, Chicanos during the movement as, you know, these Mexican-American or assimilationist type of works.
Thank you. This is great, right? Because this will give me a chance, I think, to clarify some of the story that I was telling earlier about the misalignment of assimilation sociology in Chicano literature and the Chicano movement. And also, I just love these books so much, and I just am so excited when people want to talk about them. So the books that I talk about in chapter one are Américo Pérez's novel, George Washington Gomez, which was written in the late 1930s, but not published until 1990. And then the novel Caballero, which was written by Jovito González, and Eve Rally is the pseudonym of González's co-author. Co-author's real name was Margaret Eimer. And then the third novel is Pocho by José Antonio Villarreal,
right?
Which was published in 1959. Okay, so you're right. These three novels have often been read as assimilationist, and one of the things that some of the aspects of them that I find really interesting are that. Let me go back. Okay. I get so excited to talk about them that I almost don't know where to start. So,
no problem.
The historical moment in which they're written and published is really important because it precedes the Chicano movement.
Right.
So it gives us a chance to look at some texts that are thinking about the kinds of cultural changes we describe with the word assimilation, before the anti-assimilationist kind of ethos of the Chicano movement rises to prominence.
Right.
So, in other words, they're almost like the control group, right? Like, what? Mm-hmm. How would you write a novel about assimilation if you didn't yet have the language of assimilation to write it?
Right.
And interestingly, and in all three of these novels, the word assimilation, that word I think only occurs once, and it's one reference in Pocho, right? So in Washington Gomez talks about Americanization, which was an earlier term, or a term from earlier in the 20th century. Caballero doesn't really have a term. It also uses the word assimilation once, excuse me. And then Pocho uses the word assimilation once. Okay, so how are you going to depict this? So if we were going by the terms of assimilation sociology, right, if we were going to say these are assimilationist novels, well, maybe they would understand themselves according to the same terms of assimilation sociology. Well, that would mean that they understood assimilation to be a matter of what some contemporary assimilation sociologists refer to as boundary crossing assimilation, which is the idea that there's a kind of bright line that separates the ethnic culture from the dominant culture, and all you got to do is walk over it.
Yeah.
You make some choices, and you can become American.
Right.
And that's not what is happening in these novels, really, at all. Right? Instead, what they depict are moments of intense cultural dynamism, where the encounters between cultures, uneven as they are producing new cultural formations.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And one of the really important parts of the new cultural formations produced by these novels, especially in George Washington Gomez and in Pocho, which are both set during the Great Depression, is a big shift in the way that we understand race in America. And a lot of, I'm building in this chapter on the work of some historians, David Rediger and Matthew Fry Jacobson and May Nye, who have traced the expanding boundaries of whiteness in the late 20s through the 1940s. The way that, European ethnics who would formerly have been considered not quite fully white, Italian Americans and Greeks and Jews, right, were enfolded and incorporated into American whiteness. But that this happened paradoxically by hardening the racial boundary between white and non-white.
Right.
And you see that in really interesting ways in George Washington Gomez and Pocho, especially in the ways that the Mexican-American characters are interacting with a variety of white ethnic, white ethnic characters, Asian-American characters, African-American characters, right? By paying such strict attention to, is this a Mexican-American character who's becoming American, we've kind of lost the kind of rich interracial dynamics of these books. And then the other aspect of this I think that's really important is that these are books that are intensely interested in gender and sexuality. Becoming American for Wallington in George Washington Gomez has partly to do with becoming a man, right? Becoming an American man. He has this sort of emasculating encounter with his father-in-law near the end of the novel where the father-in-law kind of makes fun of his name, George Washington, right? He says, what kind of a name is that for Mexican? And you can see there, right, that this is not just about Wallington or George. He's got two names in the novel. It's not just about Wallington choosing Americanness. It's about Wallington trying to consolidate a certain version of masculinity, right? One that corresponds to white middle class Americanness, one that is grounded in a mode of superiority, a mode of aggression, a mode of kind of assumed centrality, right? Like that you know that you're the center of things, right? That you're the pole that the world revolves around,
right?
And so these are, just some of the ways that I see these books as really upsetting the assumptions that we make about what it means to be an assimilationist novel or to be assimilationist.
Right, and that also, the label of them being assimilationists was part of the politics, right, of the Chicano movement, right, and kind of a way of interpreting, you know, previous works and politics as different than your own, and thereby, in some necessity, you know, there had to be some works to be labeled Mexican-American to distinguish from the Chicano works. I mean, am I kind of getting that right?
Yeah. Yes, that's absolutely right. So this is another reason that the kind of writing and publication dates of these novels is so important. So if on the one hand they're upsetting, some of the assumptions of assimilation sociology, on the other hand they're also upsetting some of the assumptions of anti-assimilationism during the Chicano movement. And one of those assumptions was, one of the ways that assimilationism worked in the Chicano movement was through this generational narrative that said that Chicanos were rejecting the assimilationism of a prior generation, the Mexican American generation. Right. So once you say, well, maybe that generation was not assimilationist after all. If we reject the very terms of assimilation and begin to think about them differently, then we have to reject the idea that they're assimilationist. And that, you know, that ripples forward and makes it, you know, really, I think, really should make us question what it means to be anti-assimilationist and that entire generational narrative, which I think has, I think it's a suspect narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I completely agree. It's been a very persuasive and dominating, if you will, you know, narrative, I think, within Chicano scholarship that is yet to be effectively, I think, countered in ways. But I think what a lot of recent scholarship has started to show is how porous that narrative is, you know, and that it, particularly as it was initially articulated and really emphasized, I think, by the Chicano generation, that the divisions are much more blurred now, as we've come to see through scholarship, particularly the last 10, 20 years or so, than initially it was presented, right? The distinctions both in politics and whatnot, but.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, a book that does a really great job of that is Alicia Schmidt Camacho's Migrant Imaginaries, that just, you know, insists that the history of what we think of as Chicano activism, but really kind of left labor, Mexican-American organizing, goes way back, right? That, long before the kind of advent of the Chicano movement.
Exactly. Well, I do want to give us another, a little bit more time to talk at least about one more chapter. So I'm trying to figure struggling now to try to pick one. And I'm tottering between 3 and 4. I think both of those chapters, all of them bring up really, I think, poignant themes and by themes I also mean assumptions about assimilation, and how it works. That just pervade, you know, popular and, you know, media and policy discourse. So particularly like in chapter 3, one of the strong themes that comes up there is the aspect of cultural capital and class mobility as key signifiers, right, of assimilation.
Right.
Right. And perhaps I don't know if there's an aspect of assimilation that is more powerful, that is assumed that if one, you know, is able to experience some type of economic mobility, then that automatically leads to, assimilation. The other one that you bring out really great, I think, in a number of the chapters, is also the aspect of gender, you know, which goes so well. It is a complete blind spot of assimilation theory, particularly the aspect of female bodies being actually the kind of embodiment of where the corporal embodiment, that is, of where assimilation occurs, right? It's almost like,
right,
in ways that even though it was a turn away from eugenicist type of thinking, there's still this aspect of breeding, you know, that you can breed out, you know, the ethnic culture, I think assimilation sociology didn't and still hasn't essentially gotten away from, because that's still a measure of assimilation is intermarriage, right?
Absolutely.
So, go ahead.
This point on female bodies too, I mean, not only an interesting kind of crux of assimilation, but also one of its kind of limit points, right? So in chapter 4, which is a chapter about Santos Cisneros' poetry, I talk did some length about the culture of poverty hypothesis in sociology and the really interesting link between the culture of poverty hypothesis and assimilation sociology. And that link is, in fact, the kind of frightening figure in public discourse of the single mother, the mm-hmm. poor single mother, right? So that's the figure that I argue unites Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the report on the Negro family, right, which is what many people see as the kind of the beginning of culture of poverty hypothesis, with some earlier texts, especially Beyond the Melting Pot and Oscar Lewis's Five Families. So they're all united around this figure of the single mother, and that's a figure that Cisneros takes up and turns around and is able to celebrate and transform in her poetry and her prose in really important ways.
You know, that's such a great point, and that's one of the things I love most about chapter four. I think it did really a great job of I think as you mentioned posing that Chicana feminist, and it's not so much a critique because again it was a representation, it was a cultural representation of her experience, but really it just untethers that narrative of the culture of poverty. So can you just go a bit more along that line and talk a bit more about, how you interpret Cisneros' work, particularly her poetry, as really countering that thesis?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that I'm trying to do with Cisneros is address what some people have seen as a problem in the narrative of the House on Mango Street, which is at the end of Mango Street, the fact that the narrator protagonist Esperanza is going to go away, that she, or and even throughout the novel, that she desires to leave. So that it seems to be a novel about individual escape, right? And some critics have felt kind of uncomfortable with that, right? It doesn't demonstrate the kind of commitment to a collective or a community that should be, maybe the foundation of a Chicano literary text.
Right, which means then escape is interpreted as assimilation, right?
Exactly, right. And that becomes a way of, again, using anti-assimilationism to evaluate the authenticity or the value of a literary work. And I want to say that there's something really different going on in Cisneros's work, and that you can see more, I think, acutely in her poetry. And especially, I think it's important because she was trained as a poet at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. So there's kind of two aspects to this. But one aspect is just to think about Cisneros as responding specifically to culture of poverty discourse. So to say that if you've got this discourse that's been so hugely influential, and maybe I should gloss what culture of poverty discourse is quickly.
Thank you.
It's the idea that although there might be sort of structural conditions that result in certain people, becoming impoverished or poor, that they develop behaviors or values that are self-defeating and entrap them in their poverty, right? So it's basically, it has been understood, I think, by a lot of critics, and rightfully so, as a way of blaming the victim, right?
Exactly.
Saying that if poor people are poor, it's their fault because they have these cultural values that keep them poor. So I want to say that a really key part of cultural poverty discourse is the figure of the single mother, right? Mm-hmm. So in the Moynihan Report, for example, there's a lot of attention to the fact that black families, it's a report on the quote-unquote Negro family,
right?
That black families are often matriarchal, and that therefore, these mothers are, they don't have sufficient time or energy or capacity to teach their children anything other than, the values that are associated with the culture of poverty. And that's right. What's leading families to be trapped in this cycle. Well, it's not just black families, right? What Cisneros is attuned to is the way that the Chicana families, Puerto Rican families, many different non-white kind of ethnic or immigrant groups have been stigmatized through a similar discourse. portraying then the upward mobility of poor women of color has become and I don't want to say just the upward mobility, portraying the empowerment, portraying the the capacity for change, the creative capabilities of poor women of women of color has become really, I want to say, just an integral part of Cisneros' mission as a creative artist. And to understand Esperanza's transformation in that way, rather than as, you know, rejecting Mexican culture, I think, you know, really, really shifts how we read that novel. But there's, you know, there's another part of it too, which is thinking about this, the lyric poetry and the kind of different theories that circulate about the status of the speaker in the lyric poetry, the I that speaks the poem. And that might be kind of going into the weeds a little bit too much, but maybe I'll just leave that as like a teaser. Like if you want to like, if you really want to kind of get into it about lyric poetry, then you should, you know, you should buy the book, but you should read that chapter because I kind of get into it a little bit.
No, certainly, certainly. Well, and I think that's a great place to kind of leave off and leave that teaser. We could honestly go on. I would love to talk a bit more about some of the other chapters, but we are short for time. And so we'll leave that. Yes, we do encourage our listeners to purchase the book, or at least encourage your libraries to and check it out. And it's just it's full of just wonderful examples and discussions of again, how these again, first as a literary history. I mean, that's on its own. There's tons of value there with the book. But then also, of course, my particular interest is this, you know, through line of you know, this engagement on where, you know, these two literatures in particular and institutions intersect. I think was just a great intervention and a great project that's been a part of this book. So
thank you.
I did want to give you some time, just a few minutes here, to tell us what it is you're working on now. Are you still engaged mostly in promoting this book? Are there other projects on the horizon?
I've started it. Well, there's always like so much going on. So a couple of different things. So I have two chapters of Ends of Assimilation are specifically about poetry. There's that chapter about Sandro Cisneros, and then a chapter about Jimmy Santiago Vaca's poetry. And I've continued to pursue an interest in Latino poetry, Chicano poetry, and Latino poetry more generally. I have an essay that's going to be part of a volume coming out from Wesleyan about Rosa Alcala, who's a poet I love, that is a professor at in the bilingual creative writing program at UTEP, and then a couple of other kind of things in the works. So that's one sort of avenue that I'm continuing to pursue. But I also have and this is more my primary research interest right now, is a project that I'm working on about U.S. Spanish language newspapers in the early 20th century. And it's really building on, you know, it's funny that you were talking about the institutionalized discourses, because one of the one part of the research that I did for Ends of Assimilation that became very important to me was thinking about institutions and thinking about the place of Chicano literature in institutions.
Right.
And I began to think about, well, what is the longer story of institutions of Latino literature? And so the project that I'm working on now, its main argument is that newspapers were the most important literary institution for Latino communities. The early 20th century. There's a huge, you know, there are hundreds of these newspapers, and they published an incredible, just enormous body of literature. Much of it was Latin American literature that was being circulated in the United States, but there's a lot of original literary works, original poetry and fiction written by U.S. Latinos that has been, you know, really kind of ignored. And my current research project is a kind of archaeology, right? Trying to reconstruct of the literary world of U.S. Latino communities in the early 20th century and make an argument for its vitality. I think that we don't don't really have a good understanding of the long durée of U.S. Latino literary history.
Yes, you know, I agree with that wholeheartedly, and I can't wait to see how that project develops, because it really intersects a lot with, you know, the research that I do, and more of, you know, Chicano communities in Southern California, particularly Orange County, is my focus between the 1930s and 1960s. I've started to unearth, you know, a lot of these. And when I say a lot, I mean a lot. I mean, I'm shocked as to how many ethnic newspapers I'm finding just little pieces of. Of course, there's very little record in any type of an archive or listing, publisher's listing, you know, even on Hispanic newspaper search engine sites. You know, most of them don't exist. But the amount that I'm just finding existed in the few communities that I study, it really has gotten me to rethink how these communities existed, and that there's this whole print culture, you know, institution, even as we're using that word, that existed, you know, throughout that whole period. And it's throughout a period where, again, of course, the Latino communities were presumed to be small and mostly immigrant working class, not very intellectual, not really engaged with, you know, civics and, you know, letters and things of that sort. And when you read these newspapers, it's the opposite picture is what emerges, right? And when you start to get grasp the number of them, which is, again, I mean, your project is really wonderful. It's going to be really hard, you know, right, trying to find them, because you're looking for relics. Archaeology is the right term, because those things are buried in people's garages. They are, you know, maybe in a public library somewhere, one edition or half of a an edition of, you know, of a run that issued, have a paper that maybe lasted for a year or two. So, that's great work. I'm really excited to see how that comes out.
Yeah, we should talk. I mean, your research sounds so exciting, and it sounds like there's a lot of overlap. Yeah, but really, you know, there's so much great work done on the 19th century, and, you know, this a kind of or earlier period of Latino literary history, you know, Kirsten Silva Gruz and Raúl Coronado and Jesse Alemán and Rodrigo Lasso and Marisa López, you know, so much great work. But I think that there's a gap there, at least in literary history, right? Mm-hmm. Those first decades of the 20th century, where, you know, there's some focus on some kind of big works like George Washington Gomez or there's this novel called Don Chipote by Daniel Venegas that there's been some attention paid to. But I think the literary world that these communities moved in was much richer and more dynamic than the picture that we have of it so far.
Right. Definitely. Hey, John, well, thanks again for coming on to the podcast. And it's just been a pleasure talking to you about your work. And, you know, best of luck, you know, in your future studies and ventures. And I'm sure we'll bump into each other sometime soon.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning in to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the podcast. And I hope you've enjoyed my conversation today with John Alba Cutler, author of Ends of Assimilation, The Formation of Chicano Literature, published by Oxford University Press in 2015. I'd love to hear your comments and feedback on today's podcast, and you may provide that by subscribing to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and commenting there, or sending me an email directly at newbooksinlatinostudies@gmail.com. You may also reach out to me via Twitter or Facebook.